Hi, this is Pete Fornital with the Crawdaddy Rock Review, produced in association with the editors of Crawdaddy Magazine and presented by Discwasher, makers of ultimate record care equipment. Stay tuned for a fast hour of music, news, and interviews. On this edition of the Crawdaddy Rock Review, we'll feature Melissa Manchester, who talks about her long commitment to music and performing. We'll also feature a very special interview with a truly great star, Johnny Winter. We'll also have our regular nonsense facts, comedy classics, and music reviews. We'll start with a listen to Gentle Giant as the Crawdaddy Rock Review continues. Now the Crawdaddy Rock Review, presented by Discwasher, brings you thoughts and reactions to a brand new album release. You can't blame Gentle Giant. As they reach their 10th album, only a fanatical cult had heard them. Compositions, masterpieces of counterpoint, dissonant madrigals, rock fugues, multiple riffs interlocking like cogs in cogs, went unnoticed. Meanwhile, Frank Zappa and Jethro Tull tried a bit of Giant-inspired polyphony, and Kansas stole a Gentle Giant arrangement and went platinum. So, on their new album, The Missing Piece, Giant has wised up. Now they only write one or two tunes per song instead of four that fit on top of each other. Snappy riff like 2 Weeks in Spain, or the ballad I'm Turning Around, or the half-hearted polyphony of side two may impress new converts. But according to the editors of Crawdaddy magazine, old admirers know they've been betrayed. This is Pete Fornital back on the Crawdaddy Rock Review, brought to you by Discwasher, and my guest this segment is Melissa Manchester, whom we discovered just before taping time have something very much in common, which is our roots in the Bronx, New York. Did your music, in fact, start in the Bronx?
Well, certainly from in terms of my family, because my father's a musician with the Metropolitan Opera. The family used to come over and we used to sing and whatever, and I used to take my little music stand out at the age of 8 years old, you know, instead of practicing piano, which I should have been doing, I guess. I would put on a record on our new hi-fi system, and I would take a pencil and conduct.
And then your instinct to perform developed when, beyond your conducting in the apartment?
My conducting career? Well, I started doing commercials when I was 15, collecting residuals at the same time, which was very nice.
Yes.
Came in very handy when I started to put a band together. I became a staff writer at 17 at Chapel. Then I started doing clubs at about the age of 19, and I guess I'd always wanted to, but I had made demo records. You know, I'd get my residuals together, and then I'd put all my money into making various styles of demos, and been rejected a number of times. But it just kept me going. I just kept doing it over and over again.
What was your role model? What was your goal? Who did you imagine yourself growing into by pursuing this as a career?
A star.
That
a
was
star.
It, huh?
Yes. I used to have fantasies of being followed by the Beatles on West End Avenue and Richard Rodgers.
Very eclectic combination.
Yeah, you know. And also the fact that the first time I saw Streisand, it was just amazing. I mean, this was like something that gives you hope. There's this lunatic girl that all I wanted to do was babysit for her. That's all I wanted to do.
That's great.
You know?
Let me talk for a minute about your writing. When did you begin composing?
Some friends of mine were writing songs, and they couldn't sing. So they found out that I can hum on tune. So they said, "Oh, would you come up to the publishing companies with us and sing?" So I said, "Sure." So they'd get in their little suits, and I'd get in my little dress and my little pumps, and we'd trot up there, and we'd sing. And I'd watch these friends of mine writing, and I'd been writing terrible poetry, you know, as your obligation to write terrible poetry when you're 14.
But of course.
So I'd watch these friends of mine write some songs, and I tried it, and it was really fun. So I backtracked to one of the publishing companies, and I got myself a staff writing job. I'd been writing about 7.5 minutes, and I got myself a staff writing job.
How does one make the transition from doing demos or writing on staff to recording artists?
Took a while because we kept getting rejected by these record companies. But when it finally happened, my first producers were Hank Mitchell and Dave Apple for Bell Records. It was very serious. But when you have a platform like an album, you know, somebody's saying, "Okay, go do it." We went in with some fine studio musicians and we tried things. I had no idea of direction or concepts. I had no, you know, I didn't think that far ahead or that clearly.
There was, to my ears anyway, such a marked difference between the first two and then the third, which turned out to be the one to do things for you.
Right.
How do you perceive that now? What was the difference?
Perhaps initially it was Vinnie Poncia being the new producer. His frame of reference was working with Richard Perry, writing with Ringo Starr.
There was
plus the fact that the songs were, I don't know, I thought that the songs were terrific on the first two albums. But the songs lend themselves to different kinds of experimentations. The people that I was working with were into different kinds of things. I mean, before I went out to California to work with Vinny, anybody that was using a synthesizer to me was not to be trusted.
Ah.
You know, because I came from, only in my head, where if you were using a synthesizer, you were taking the jobs away of 12 starving string players. You know, and my father, who is a classical musician, he would say, are you going to get off this crusade? What are you, nuts? He said, I never told you to think like this. He said, you're crazy. You know, and I first met James Newton Howard, who now works with Elton John.
Right.
And we worked together on the Melissa album, which was the first album I worked with Vinny. And he's a classical musician. And when I first met him, he had all these synthesizers in his living room. And I was prowling around like a caged tigress, you know. I said, what do you think of all of this electronic stuff? And he looked at me very cautiously. He said, and there was Vinny, like the referee between the two of us. He said, well, believe me, I don't think this substitutes anything. I was nuts. I mean, I was just so naive.
You must have intimidated him.
It was great. We ended up loving each other a lot.
Did the success of Midnight Blue and that album change your life in good ways, bad ways?
Well, it certainly changed it in many good ways, in wonderfully wonderful ways. Midnight Blue was not what you call out-of-the-box success, you know what I mean? It was what's called a work record, where you have to go around and say, please play this, you know? Please. I know it's a ballad, I know it's a female, I know it's everything that's against me, but, you know. But it changed my life in terms of not having to fight for acceptance once I got on stage.
While we're on the subject of songwriting, do you mind talking about the encounter you had with Paul Simon?
I studied the year that I left NYU, which was the same year I entered. The same friends of mine who had taken me up to this publishing company signed my name up for a course called Paul Simon, Songwriting and Record Production. Well, at the time, Bridge Over Troubled Waters was number one all over the galaxy. But there was this audition where hundreds of people just lined up the street to get into this class. And he held the auditions personally. He picked 8 people. And it was a wonderful class in that I don't know if one can teach songwriting to one who doesn't want to learn. I mean, if you want to learn songwriting, you're going to find things in you to write about or things that touch you enough in the form of expressing themselves in the form of songwriting. But what was wonderful about the class was that the stories that were swapped about survival in the business, we did in fact sit around dissecting songs and analyzing them. He would come in and play songs that he was working on, and we were all like 18 years old, and we'd go, P.U., that stinks, get out of here. You know, it was great, it was just wonderful. But I did learn things, you know, his idea of saying things simply and honestly or saying things in such a unique way that nobody will understand it, but they'll all connect with it, you know, like Jabberwocky.
Let's apply this to the circumstances that led to the most recent album, which was Singin'. Mm-hmm. It was a departure for you, do you agree?
Mm-hmm, sure.
How did your team go about, say, choosing the material to record, et cetera?
Well, mostly the choice was made by Vinny and myself. The reason for not writing on the album, the reason for hiring myself out as a singer on the album was on the polite end, because I enjoyed singing those songs and I appreciate those writers along with a volume of others. But on the not so polite form, I was just burnt out, and I just didn't feel it would be a good thing to be sharing what I was writing about.
Do you have a favorite on the album?
Hard to say. Warmth of the Sun I've wanted to record for a long time.
If you said you hadn't, I was going to say that I do, and let's listen to some of Warmth of the Sun.
Sure. Grows into day.
That's Warmth of the Sun, Beach Boys song, that appears in a version done by Melissa Manchester on her most recent album, Singin'. I love the cover.
Thanks.
Who came up?
Singin' dot, dot, dot.
Dot, dot, dot. That's right. Melissa, continued success in your recording career, and thanks for stopping by the Crawdaddy Rock Review.
Thank you.
This is Pete Fornital back on the Crawdaddy Rock Review. It's time now for Crawdaddy's Comedy Classics. We all remember Stan Freberg for his uncanny ability to describe the full imagination range of radio. Freberg's humorous series of radio commercials made the point that merely listening could beat the visual impact of TV hands down.
Listen, you can do things on radio you couldn't possibly do on TV.
That'll be the day.
All right, watch this. Okay, people, and now when I give you the cue, I want the 700-foot mountain of whipped cream to roll into Lake Michigan, which has been drained and filled with hot chocolate. Then the Royal Canadian Air Force will fly overhead towing a 10-ton maraschino cherry, which will be dropped into the whipped cream for the cheering of 25,000 extras. All right, cue the mountain. Cue the Air Force. Cue the maraschino cherry. Okay, 25,000 cheering extras. Now, you want to try that on television?
In the summer of 1957, Stan Freberg delivered his madcap zany point of view to a weekly radio audience, unafraid, undaunted, and unsponsored. Alone, except for the 6 million foolhardy souls who joined him for each wild, exaggerated flight of fancy, here's a typical sample as Stan Freberg interviews the Abominable Snowman.
Standing next to this particular gentleman, creature, what is it you are there?
A little of each, Stan, actually.
A little of each.
That's right.
I see, then you are the abominable...
Snowman, that's right. I never cared for that word abominable too much, Stan. You mind if I called you Stan?
No, not at all.
Well, I never cared for abominable, but it's the nearest word translated from the original Hindustani, which was Abominuya Mayo, which means the hairy one with the big feet.
Yeah, I can see it lost something in the translation. I was noticing your...
Noticing my sneakers there, were you?
Quite large. Yeah, what are they, about 12?
What, are you kidding? 12, they're size 23. I send up to Spalding's, they make them up for me. I have them in four colors. I'm wearing the orange today.
Oh, that's very nice.
Well, that's the particular ensemble I picked out today.
Oh, it's not much of an ensemble, is that? I mean, it's just the shoes.
Well, it's an ensemble to me. Some of us aren't too well off as others.
Well, I didn't mean to hurt your feelings.
Oh, that's all right.
It's all right?
Yes, it is.
Okay.
Okay.
All right.
All right, fine, fine.
Say, you're quite tall, you know. What are you, about 8, 9 feet?
No, I measure in around 10 and a half, buddy.
10 and a half feet tall? Hee! That's pretty tall.
You think I'm tall? You should see my brother. He'd jump center for Abominable State.
Well, I'm sorry I missed him. Have you had a pretty good day's work today? Done much terrorizing?
No, not too much today.
Well, I wonder if you could give us a demonstration before we sign off of whatever it is you do.
To terrorize the mountain climbers? Certainly.
Well, what would you like me to do?
Well, just turn your back there and close your eyes. Close your little eyes, and I sort of sneak up behind you and let fly with one.
Let fly with one what?
Never you mind, just turn your back.
Well, I think I have a...
Never mind, just turn your back, please. No peeking.
All right.
Don't you open those eyes now.
I won't.
All right. I'll just sneak up behind you now, tippy-toe. Which is hard with my feet. Here I come now. Gave you a little start there, didn't I, Stanley? Say, that white hair is very becoming. Sets off your ruddy complexion. Very nice.
Gee, that was effective. Well?
Well, if you'll forgive me, I gotta get back to work. I see a mountain climber over there by the edge.
Well, nice meeting you.
Nice meeting you, Stan.
That's it for today's Crawdaddy Comedy Classic. This is Pete Fornital. And now the Crawdaddy Rock Review, presented by Dishwasher, gives you a capsule summary of thoughts and reactions to a brand new album release. If the Smoke Dreams of Return to Forever were your first encounter with Chick Corea, then his newest album release may seem stark and scary. The album is ARC, and there are no fanfares, flourishes, pretty words, or bouncy rhythms. It's a new, old release, which was recorded 6 years ago and just released in the States. The album catches Corea riding a tidal wave of creativity. He had just left Miles Davis's group and was traveling in the company of such feverish trailblazers as Dave Holland, Barry Altschul, and Anthony Braxton. Thank you. Korea's acoustic piano sings with passion and grace. It's clear to the editors of Crawdaddy magazine that his solo introductions to Nefertiti and Vidana foreshadow his later solo albums. ARC presents Chick Corea with a triangle of strong personalities for an LP of tremendous musical excitement.